It is my pleasure to introduce to you our next speaker, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, who I certainly know is a very fine friend and a wonderful colleague of some yesteryears. Dr. Schmidt just reminded me that before his real life as a scholar, he was in the Royal Canadian Mounties. He assured me that he had never ridden a horse up a canyon and been semi-drowned. That apparently is the fate only of DPs who, in my experience at least, often fall off their horse. I also understand that he's in a board meeting right now, so he didn't hear that. And I often tell my students what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and sometimes it's not true. In any case, Dr. Schmidt studied at Valpo, where he already concentrated in his specialty of sociology. In those years, of course, everyone who went to a secular school and most who went to Valpo became pastors in the Missouri Synod by way of Springfield. And then he taught for 10 years at Seward and 2 years at Lenoir Rhine before coming here to CTS in 1975, just one quarter before I did. He was here in the Department of Practical Theology until 1987, and I remember those years very well. It was the years when we were developing our Doctor of Ministry program, and Al was crucially important for that program precisely by virtue of his sociological expertise. Later, he was professor of sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, retiring there in 1999. Since that time, he has published a number of very interesting books that have received very wide acclaim and readership. Among them, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, a book that I think probably lies behind this lecture today, Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization, or How Christianity Changed the World, another book, which he told me now has been translated into 7 languages, the most recent, if I remember, Al, in Russian. Then also a book I have not myself looked at, The American Muhammad, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. We're happy also that he brought with him his most wonderful wife, Carol. I shouldn't say most wonderful wife. That implies that there's a less than wonderful wife. I guess goes to show, you know, sometimes the best compliments are problematic, you know. Well, he has a wonderful wife, Carol, and it's wonderful to have her here. So let me introduce or have you applaud, please, Dr. Schmidt, who's going to give us a presentation entitled When Culture Was First Made Christian, The Accomplishments of Constantine and Theodosius I. Please, Al.
Bright lights. Thank you. And I want to thank Dr. David Scare for assigning me this topic. It's exactly the way he gave it to me. I will make a couple of qualifying comments on it. You know, the book of Joel, the prophet Joel says, your young men shall see visions and your old men shall dream dreams. What I'm about to share with you, I hope, is not what I have dreamed. Culture is a word and I'm perhaps more conscious of it than anyone else, that it's a day used by so many people in so many contexts, and most of the time they don't know what they're talking about when they use the word culture. It's become a label. Yet if you go back 50 years in the academic world, culture was only used by professional cultural anthropologists. Or if it was used at all, it was used in terms of sophisticated music like Bach and listening to Mozart. That was culture. Well, today we've moved away from that. And I used to teach a course called cultural anthropology. And I've always had an interest in culture. Even sociologists don't do a lot with culture. They focus primarily on social structure rather than on culture. It is still pretty much the bailiwick of cultural anthropologists. But nevertheless, to me, it's always been an interest of mine to look at culture. And when we talk about culture becoming Christianized, I realize historians use the word Christianized, but they never really tell you what they totally mean by it. It really has two meanings. Is it Christianized in terms of a given society taking certain Christian values? Is that what is meant by Christianized? Or do they mean that the whole society became Christian? Obviously, it's not the latter. And when I hear people talk about culture, I often look for a definition. You know, culture defined, really, here's my definition that I've used many times, and the cultural anthropologist would go with it. Culture is a society's values, beliefs, and practices that are institutionalized. Now, that means culture belongs to society. The Amish, for example, are a subculture. They're not a separate culture, but that's how we confuse the terms today. Or some little group has a different behavior, we say that's their culture. Well, really not. And I don't want to belabor the point, but it's another example that illustrates the wide use of culture today, and it's often not clearly understood. I will focus on how Constantine and Theodosius introduced Christian values into the West. Not the Orient, into the West. But again, I'm not saying they made Western society Christian. That's where we'll quibble over it. For the most part, these two towering individuals had a tremendous impact on the world. Let me begin with Constantine before 312. By the way, my good friend Dr. Weinrich said Constantine. I usually say Constantine. I've checked with sources and they say either one's okay, so I'm going to use Constantine because it's more familiar to me. So Constantine before 312. Although the exact date and the place of Constantine's birth is not certain, most historians think that Helena, allegedly once a stablemaid and reportedly a concubine of Constantius, a Roman military officer, gave birth to Constantine in about 272. Some will say it is even a little later. In Naissus of Moesia, today what we would say Serbia. Although Constantine was born in Serbia, he spent considerable time in his formative years in the court of Nicomedia, apparently held as a hostage by Emperor Diocletian in order to keep his father, Constantius, a skilled general loyal to him. In 293, Emperor Diocletian created the Tetrarchy, basically divided the empire into four regional administrative areas. So he selected Maximinian as a co-Augustus, and in turn, each of them appointed a Caesar under them. So that gave you four individuals. Two Augusti, and then each had a Caesar for the Tetrarchy of the four divisions. But when Diocletian and Maximinian abdicated in 305, and by the way, this is what launched the great persecution in 305 under Diocletian, that essentially existed till 311 with the Edict of Toleration by Galerius. And then we come a couple of years later to Constantine. But when Diocletian and Maximinian abdicated in 305, Galerius became the Augustus, the senior emperor, who for conniving reasons decided not to choose Constantine, Constantius' son, as his Caesar. Suspecting a political intrigue, Constantine one night outwitted Galerius, who had imbibed too much wine. And during Galerius' intoxication, Constantine maimed his horses and escaped to join his father in Gaul, modern France. When Diocletian in 303 launched the great persecution of the Christians as it is known in history, Constantine's father, Constantius, a Caesar, could not avoid taking part in persecuting the Christians. He destroyed some churches in his diocese, but as a mild-mannered monotheistic Caesar, which was atypical among the Caesars in the pagan Roman Empire, he was a monotheist, he was not a polytheist. He treated Christians leniently and never tortured or executed any. He also had good rapport with his son Constantine, a rapport that resulted in his taking his father as a military role model. The army in Britannia recognized this, and so it selected him as Caesar in the very day that his father died in 306. The wholesome father-son relationship, along with Constantine having seen the immense harm the great persecution did to Christians and also how it harmed the empire, helps us understand the actions he took a few years later in his support of Christianity. The battle at Milvian Bridge. In October 312, Constantine, Caesar of Spain, Britain, and Gaul, the western part of the empire, since 306, marched from the north from Gaul with an elite troops, pared down in number to a considerable degree, and he headed toward Rome to fight Maxentius, his brother-in-law, by the way, and a usurper of the emperor's throne, whose troops greatly outnumbered Constantine's. On his long trip to Rome, he and his soldiers one day saw a bright light as a cross above the sun with the Greek words, en tuto nike, in this sign. I know your Latin edition says in this sign conquer, but that's not what really happened, and according to Eusebius too. He did not know its meaning until he had a dream at night that told him to use this sign when fighting his enemies. Heeding his dream, he designed a new military standard with a Christian cross mounted on a long spear and a crossbar known as the Liberium. Constantine had his honor guard of 50 trusted soldiers, renowned for their personal courage and Christian piety, carry it at the front of Constantine's troops in every battle. He first used it in his battle against Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge. In preparation for the battle, Maxentius, confident of victory, and he knew that Constantine was coming, had destroyed the Milvian Bridge and built a pontoon bridge over the Tiber River so that Constantine would not be able to use the real bridge and use the pontoon bridge as a trap for Constantine's army. This forced Maxentius' troops finally, as the battle began, he pushed back, Constantine pushed back Maxentius' troops to the brink of the river. This forced them to retreat onto this pontoon man-made bridge, and it did collapsed in disaster, and Maxentius himself drowned. Now Constantine had defeated his enemy. He was the sole Augustus now of the western part of the Roman Empire, and he proceeded to ride into the city of Rome. Crowds cheered and welcomed him, and the Senate proclaimed him Liberator Urbis, the liberator of the city, as a relief from the city that it had suffered under for a number of years under Maxentius' oppressive rule. Constantine's pro-Christian acts. When Constantine defeated Maxentius on October 28, 312, he converted to Christianity. He had now seen that this sign that he saw in the sky demonstrated that God was behind his plans. It was an argument, by the way, that has intrigued a lot of scholars. You can read a lot of interesting literature on this topic. The numerous pro-Christian actions he took following his victory at 312, only a few weeks later, after he defeated him, indicate that the man was not just a Christian, mentally speaking or emotionally, but he actually wanted to change things in society. So when he marched into Rome, his triumph culture required him to enter the Capitolium and offer a sacrifice to the pagan god Jupiter. But he did not. He refused. It did not go over well relative to the citizens of Rome. And it's also important to note, as one historian says, Constantine's letters had a very, quote, personal and characteristic touch. They all breathe an earnestness of belief. In other words, the man was genuine relative to his Christianity. Mere political pragmatism, of which he has often been accused, fails to explain his numerous pro-Christian actions that I will cite momentarily. The Edict of Milan. In February of 313, Constantine, now Augustus of the West, and Licinius, Augustus of the Eastern Empire, met in Milan, where Constantine gave his half-sister, Constantia, in marriage to Licinius. Either before or the night after the wedding, both men drafted an agreement that granted religious freedom and tolerance to Christians and also to the pagans. It is not like some historical books say Christianity here became the official religion. No, 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 no. That happened a lot longer. We'll see that happening with Theodosius. Licinius had tolerated the Christians in the East since Galerius' edict of 311. He did not oppose Constantine's effort to produce the Edict of Milan. By the summer of 313, imperial letters, or rescripts as they were often called in the Roman society, were published at Nicomedia and Caesarea, announcing the edict's implementation, thus formally ending the persecution of the Christians. But here it also needs to be noted that even before issuing the Edict of Milan, Constantine had already ordered the restoration of churches and their properties that had been confiscated and destroyed in the Great Persecution. And in 313, he released Christian clergy from compulsory public services. Thus, here we have the origin of today's clergy exemption for military service, part of our culture, came from Constantine. He convened the Council of Arles in France. We know Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea in 325, but it's not so well known that he also convened the Council of Arles in 314, where he had hoped to resolve the Donatist schism and thereby unite divided Christendom. But when the council ended unsuccessfully, he addressed the Catholic bishops, praising their efforts. In his address, he called God, Deus Noster, our God, referred to Christ as, as Divinitas Propitia, gracious divinity, Dominus, Lord, Salvator Noster, our Savior. And he called the bishops Fraters Carissimi, dearest brothers. Interestingly, Constantine's critics who doubt the sincerity of his conversion have never been able to cite instances of him addressing the pagan priests as Fraters Carissimi, dearest brothers. Additional pro-Christian policies. In 315, he outlawed branding the faces of criminals. ordered speedy trials, and given his high regard for the Christian cross, he banned crucifying convicted criminals. In 316, he added legal methods of freeing slaves, frequently done in churches. In 318, he permitted Christians to solve legal problems in an ecclesiastical court rather than in pagan courts, as was commonly done. Also in 318, he rejected Rome's old law of patria potestas. This was part of the Roman 12 tables of Roman law, the fourth table. This law gave a father absolute power of life and death over any member in his family. Constantine repealed this law, and it's never been in existence since then. There's very interesting literature, if you wish to read something about patria potestas, where the father had absolute power. That was the law of the land. There was no repeal. What the father dedicated or pronounced took place. In 318, soothsayers were banned from entering Christian homes. In 320, he repealed laws punishing celibacy or punishing childless couples, which was common in Roman society. In 321, he declared Dies Soli, the day of Sunday, or the day of the sun, a legal holiday for urban residents, not rural, but only urban. But this law gave soldiers time off to attend Christian services, and it compelled pagan soldiers to assemble off military premises where they had to recite a monotheistic prayer that he wrote that appealed to the highest deity that everyone in the military knew referred to the Christian God. Later in Constantinople, Sundays had all public offices and shops closed. And still we see remnants of this, and by the way, not until long ago, back into the 1950s and 60s, most places on Sunday were closed. We have obviously moved away from that by now. But there you still had remnants of Constantine's influence relative to what he did to the culture of the West. Some critics have faulted him for retaining the name Sols Dies Soli, or Day of the Sun, when he created Sunday as a religious holiday. But after 324, when he defeated Licinius in the East, who had become a turncoat after the Edict of Milan, he extended the closing of Sunday activities also to the Eastern Empire as well. And in 323, he issued a law ordering public beatings or fines for any imperial official who forced Christians to participate in pagan services. Regarding pagan sacrifices, it is interesting to note that he never again took part in any such sacrifices after he became a Christian in 312. One historian said that Constantine, as a Christian military officer, had a special tent built and shaped like a cross in which he prayed to the Christian deity for inspiration for upcoming battles. Another historian states that Constantine liked to spend daily time reading the scriptures and offered regular prayers with the members of his imperial court. And he wore a helmet emblazoned with the Christogram, and his soldiers carried the shields marked with the same sign. Although time does not permit citing all the pro-Christian acts that he introduced, I would be remiss if I failed to note that he built 8 basilicas in Rome for Christian churches. He built 4 churches in Jerusalem, largely under the doing of his mother Helena, another at the Oaks of Mamre, the Church of Nativity in Bethlehem that's still pretty much intact. Many of you may have seen it. The latter churches were efforts of his mother. Apart from the churches she built, Constantine also built churches in Trier in Germany, Nicomedia, Antioch, and of course in Constantinople, where he built two very significant ones, the Church Hagioi Irene, or the Holy Irene, and Hagioi Apostoloi, the Holy Apostles' Church. 1 year before he died, He furnished the latter church with 12 cenotaphs of the apostles and left room in the middle of the apostles for himself, indicating that he saw himself as the 13th apostle of Christendom. Constantine had long desired to be baptized in the Jordan River, but given he unexpectedly became ill, seriously ill, in May of 337, he had an Arian bishop, Eusebius, from Nicomedia, a distant relative, baptize him as he died, as he shed, by the way, as he shed his purple robe for a white baptismal garment. And a few days later on Pentecost, May 22nd, he died. Now I move to Theodosius. Theodosius' pro-Christian acts. Born in 347 in what we today would say near Toledo in Spain, his father, a count, Flavius Theodosius, and his mother, Termantia, were Homusian or Nicene Christians. As a young man, Theodosius followed in his father's military footsteps, and as a general, he won some important battles under, and I'll use the English pronunciation, Valentinian, rather than, as the Latins would say, Valentinian. Valentinian I, a non-Arian Christian who took over soon after Julian the Apostate was killed in Persia. On January 379, Emperor Gratian, now a young emperor in the early 20s, appointed Theodosius to be emperor of the eastern provinces. Given the fact that Valens was killed in the Battle of Adrianople in 378. So Theodosius assumed office in January of 379. Edward Gibbon, in his Decline in the Fall of the Roman Empire, said, quote, "The fame of Constantine hath been rivaled by the glory of Theodosius," end quote. I do not intend to diminish, at least not much, of his glory, but it is important to note that some highly significant events that occurred before and during the early years of Theodosius' reign. These events undoubtedly motivated him when he became an Augustus in the East to do more in Christianizing the empire, that had still tremendously large population of pagans, together with pagan beliefs and practices. One significant event before Theodosius' reign occurred in 357, when Constantius II, the son of Constantine now, removed the altar of victory, or Victoria, the ultimate symbol of Rome's pagan supremacy, from the Senate House, or the Curia, that was called. Julian the Apostate, in his brief 18-month reign, had it restored in 362. But in 382, Christian Emperor Gratian, or Gratian in Latin, influenced by Bishop Ambrose's treatise, De Fide, in 379, removed it again, thus indicating Christian values were replacing those of pagan Rome. Gratian also took some other action that could only have encouraged Theodosius to do more to introduce Christian values. Shortly after Theodosius became emperor, Gratian rejected the title of Pontifex Maximus. That, for centuries, signified the emperor was the supreme priest of the empire, of whom all pagan priests looked for guidance. He was the first emperor to reject this title and its role and its stole. No Christian emperor used the title again. And he did more. He refused to don the purple robe that emperors had majestically worn since Caesar Augustus before Christ. He also withdrew the state's funds from the pagan priests along with the support it gave to the Vestal Virgins. To him, these pagan customs conflicted with Christian values. Apart from Constantius II and Gratian, some other Christianizing acts preceded Theodosius. Jovian, a Christian emperor who ruled for only 8 months after Julian the Apostate was killed in battle, issued an edict that made it a capital crime for any man who raped or even proposed marriage to a pledged virgin or a widow, spelled out in the Codex Theodosianus. In 365, Emperor Valentinian I and co-emperor Valens introduced a law that made it illegal for a judge to order a Christian to serve in a pagan temple. If a judge gave such an order, he would be executed and his property confiscated. And in 374, Valentinian I outlawed abortion and infanticide. I mentioned this already, by the way, in my book, How Christianity Changed the World. That's when Christians firmly took a stand against abortion and infanticide, both of which were totally legal in Roman and Greek society and widely practiced. In fact, in 364 through 375, Valentinian I, Valens, Gratian, and Valentinian II enacted 38 laws that favored Christianity before Theodosius even took office in 379. The Edict of Thessalonica, one for which Theodosius had received tremendous amount of publicity and not necessarily in an inappropriate way. In February, some say 27th, some say 28th, so I just say February of 380, the edict is commonly seen as the sole work of Theodosius, but it is not totally accurate. For the edict was really jointly issued by co-emperors Gratian and Valentinian II. Thus, the opening sentence states, "It is our desire that all various nations, subjected to our clemency and moderation, profess that religion which was delivered to the Romans by the divine apostle Peter, professed by Bishop Damasus and Peter of Alexandria, a man of apostolic holiness." The edict further declared, quote, "Let us believe in one deity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, in equal majesty and in equal holy trinity," end of quote. And it continued, to quote one more time, "We authorize the followers of this law to assume the title of Catholic Christians, but all others we decree that they shall be branded with the ignominious names of heretics and shall not presume to give their conventicles the name of churches." The edict made Nicene Christianity the official religion of the empire. But we need to remember that the creed of 325 at Nicaea was not the creed that we confess today. That creed said nothing about Christ's virgin birth, nothing about Pontius Pilate, nothing about baptism, nothing about the Holy Spirit's role, just mentions him, and it lacked the phrase "according to the scriptures." In the late summer of 380, Theodosius became seriously ill, so ill that Aquileius, a non-Arian bishop in Thessalonica, baptized him. Hence the Edict of Thessalonica and several other edicts issued the same year all appeared before he was baptized, somewhat similar to Constantine. Had he not become ill, we can only guess when he would have requested baptism. But given that the Nicene Creed in 380 said nothing about baptism, it is hard for us to fault him, perhaps, too much for not having yet been baptized. In November of 380, particularly November 26, Theodosius came to Constantinople, where he offered the See of Constantinople to Demophilus, an Arian bishop, if he were to accept and uphold the Nicene Creed. He refused, and so Theodosius expelled him, ordered him to surrender all the churches in his see. This, as Gibbons phrased it, ended the 4 decades of Constantinople, quote, being the principal seat and fortress of Arianism, end quote. A phenomenon that began with Eusebius of Nicomedia, who usurped the See of Constantinople in 338, less than a year after Constantine died, and all of the churches except one, until this edict, were Arian churches. This was the same Eusebius, by the way, that also baptized Constantine. The Council of Constantinople, 381, which we call the Second Ecumenical Council. In May of 380, Theodosius and Gratian decided a general council of bishops needed to be held the following year. Theodosius convened the council in May of 381 with 150 Catholic bishops and 36 Numumachian bishops attending, all from the east. The Numumachian bishops soon withdrew, and so 150 Catholic bishops, all basically from the east, presided. The council's first order of business denied seating the Numumachians. The gathering came to be known as the Second Council, as I mentioned. One of the council's major achievements was its expansion of the creed formulated in 325. On July 30, 381, Theodosius ratified the council's decrees by an edict. It's always been interesting to me that we as Lutherans and pastors don't often tell our members that the Nicene Creed is really not quite the correct name. But I can understand the long title really should be Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed. Because, and I guess because of brevity, we just say Nicene. Theodosius issued another decree in July of 381. He declared that the Arians, Eunomians, or fathers of Aetius, who did not confess the Trinity, forfeited their churches to the Catholic bishops, nor were they permitted to build new churches. If they did build new churches, they would be confiscated. Then in the same month, all heretical clergy and bishops were expelled from the area. Now all the churches in Constantinople were Catholic, as opposed to the only church the Catholics had, as I mentioned before, when all the Arians were in control. In July 19, 381, at least 75 additional edicts were issued. They include banning former Christians making wills. In other words, Arians were not permitted to make wills. Outlawed the divining of the future by examining entrails of the pagan Romans did when they sacrificed animals. Prohibited business transactions on Sunday. Forbade Christians and Jews from intermarrying, declared all acts of magic a crime, barred all individuals from entering pagan temples, and several edicts prevented pagan sacrifices. Of the 75 edicts, all but one were issued jointly by other emperors, not by Theodosius alone. In his Christianizing effort, Theodosius on August the 6th of 390, together with the 13-year-old son Arcadius and Valentinian II, issued a statute that criminalized homosexual behavior, punishable by burning. This edict essentially renewed the law that had been in existence already in 342 by Constantius and Constans, his brother, Theodosius' unrecognized contribution. Historians, even those who see Theodosius in a favorable light, have missed, I maintain, one of his highly significant contributions that has become a part of Western culture, morally speaking. In the spring of 390, in Thessalonica, a mob lynched and murdered Theodosius' general Botharic and several of his officers. Botharic had jailed a popular charioteer for sexually accosting a young boy. Responding in anger, Theodosius invited the Thessalonian public to games in the hippodrome. And when the spectators had filled the hippodrome, his soldiers closed the gates and followed his order, attacked and slaughtered 7,000 Thessalonians. When Ambrose in Milan, where Theodosius had his palace, heard about the massacre. He confronted him with his grievous sin. In a long and respectful worded letter, he told him to repent of his vindictive act. Initially, Theodosius did not take kindly to this letter, much less repent. And so Ambrose barred him from the communion rail. Many say he was excommunicated. Well, technically not, but he was not able to attend communion. But roughly 8 months later, reportedly on Christmas Day, Theodosius came to Ambrose's church in Milan in sackcloth and ashes. I have a picture of it in this particular book here. Prostrated himself and asked for forgiveness, bringing tears of joy to fellow Christians. As I say in my book, How Christianity Changed the World, it is unfortunate that historians have portrayed Ambrose as confronting Theodosius as a power struggle between church and state. It was not that. To the contrary, it is evident from Ambrose's letter that he was solely concerned for the emperor's spiritual welfare rather than with the church's power. He even cited King David's act of having Uriah killed in battle and thereby told the emperor that he had similarly placed himself above God's laws and committed murder, and therefore he needed to repent. Thus, when Theodosius repented, he admitted that he was not above the law, and thereby he made a major contribution to the Western culture, for to this day, most democracies hold up the banner of no man is above the law. That's its origin. You'll never find it in history, however documented as such. So I say this is one of his major contributions. Today, modern democracies say that they are above the law in terms of their government that they have. The Edict of 391. Among the 75 edicts noted earlier, the Edict of February 391 banned individuals from worshiping pagan idols, both in private and in public. Some barred people's access to pagan temples, including pagan members of Theodosius' own imperial court. Violators were fined or lost, but not executed. And it's a very important point. He did not resort to executing violators. That in itself is, I think, a noble act. One historian said that this particular edict, quote, next to the conversion of Constantine himself, was the most significant legal point in the history of 4th century Rome, end of quote. For this edict, together with Gratian's earlier rejection of Pontifex Maximus' role, left the pagans without any supreme priestly authority, and thus it led to the eventual dissolution of pagan Roman cults. This, of course, was Theodosius' objective. Although paganism did not totally die out until the early 6th century, for the pagan entertainment of having humans fighting beasts, you see it there, dangerous chariot racing, circuses that Theodosius' writings frequently refer to as evil acts, they continued till the early 6th century. Few concluding remarks. Historians have written volumes about Christianizing the Roman Empire by Constantine and Theodosius, including the pro-Christian actions that were introduced by emperors between Constantine and Theodosius. But they have failed to note one rather fact, namely that most Christian emperors, including Constantine the Great, in one significant behavior role, they did not themselves act like Christians. They did not really, in that sense, differ from the pagan emperors. They still operated with might makes right. They had not internalized, as I say, the mind of Christ, and thus politically they failed to act like Christians in spite of all their edicts they made to bring Christian values into society. Constantine, for example, in 326, had his 20 1-year-old son, Crispus, executed for supposedly having been part of a conspiracy that's never been documented. And in the same year, he executed what was now his second wife, Fausta. Might made right. Whether he ever repented of this, we do not know. Although he had reared his sons in court, Constantine II, Constantius II, and Constance, the moment the father died, they rushed to grab power. Soon after attaining power, Constance, the younger one, at age 17, together with his brother Constantius II, ambushed the oldest brother and killed him in battle. Emperor Valens, an Arian, put to death 80 Nicene priests by taking them to sea on a boat that was then set afire. And obviously, he was an Arian Christian, but nevertheless, he acted like might makes right. Magnus Maximus, a professed Nicene Christian who came from Britannia down into Gaul and finally usurped the emperorship, also forgot that he was a Christian, then took his army or some of his men and executed deceptively Gratian, another Nicene Christian. And here we have the first emperor, Christian emperor, killing a Christian emperor. Very disturbing if you read this. And as I said, they hadn't really internalized the mind of Christ. Maxentius was also the first emperor who executed Priscillian, the bishop of Avila in Spain, for heresy. And as already indicated, Theodosius massacred 7,000 civilians. And later, for example, when he defeated Magnus Maximus in the Battle of 388, Maximus pleaded for mercy, but Theodosius executed him. Thus, though a number of emperors from Constantine to Theodosius greatly contributed to the Christianizing of the West and the change of the world thereby, the process of peacefully attaining and retaining political office and power was not one of their accomplishments. That accomplishment was still waiting in a distant future. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Schmidt. And no, Dr. Reinrich has not undergone a body switch, but he had to leave. We have time for some questions, so if you would like to come to the microphones.
Hello, you know me, Jonathan Naumann.
My friend Naumann, huh?
Yes. If you, Dr. Schmidt, tell me that I should just go and read Gibbon like every good boy should have already done, then I'll just leave, but because I haven't done it. Would you maybe just tell me how Gibbon could argue, as is well known, that some sort of decadence was responsible for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire when, as you've described it, at its decline and fall, the Roman Empire was far from decadent. It was more Christian than many Western governments are today.
It was not what to say the latter part?
More Christian in some ways, less decadent than the West is today.
Oh, yes, by all means. We are slowly, not might even slowly, scuttling all the Christian influences and values in our society. Need I tell you, whether it's approving pro-abortion, whether it's same-sex marriages, and the litany goes on.
So what is Gibbon's argument? How can he say that the Christian Roman Empire was so decadent that it fell?
Was so evident, again, sorry?
That the Christian Roman Empire was so decadent that it fell.
Well, that's Gibbon. Don't forget, Gibbon was a fallen away Christian. Mm. And when he could take a poke at Christians, he did it. And That would be just another example. He also had no good words to say basically of Theodosius or of Constantine or of any major Christian accomplishments. You know, as I say, he was a fallen away Roman Catholic. And that very much, as I often used to tell my students, when you read somebody, know the background of the writer. It'll help you understand what he's saying or what he's not saying. And definitely Gibbon was of that type.
Thank you, Professor. Really appreciate your scholarship. And I just wanted to know what you think of this. And it appears to me that today, any chance they can attack Nicene Christianity, if you know what I mean, they will do it, you know. It just seems like there's this constant mantra in the media and our American culture that is attacking Nicene Christianity. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, yes. I mean, I hate to turn on the TV because most of the individuals have really no understanding of not only Christianity as portrayed in the Bible, but not and also not of its development in Western history. And therefore, you get these statements. This is why, for example, they tend to see Islam as another peaceful religion, because they know no history, vis-a-vis, for example, Christianity, and a whole other things. One of the things that I often say that's happened in our culture today, that we even as Christians have fallen for. We echo the same things. What do I have in mind? I've mentioned it many times before, but I'll mention it again because it'll take a long time for it to take root if it ever does. That is, that we have adopted what I call basically a non-biblical expression when we refer to other Christian groups as a faith. Ouch! That's unbiblical. Paul never spoke that way. There was only, the faith was only one, Christianity. And when people left Paul, he didn't say they went to another faith. But that's how we talk today. So I tell people, it's the Muslim religion, not the Muslim faith. It's the Buddhist religion, not the Buddhist faith. And you need to say that, because the moment you call those other groups faith group, you have put them on the same level with Christianity. They have no empirical scientific evidence for their faith, in which their faith is anchored, namely the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so you have diminished the Christian message by calling the other groups a faith group or faith-based political action or whatever we call it today. I've been interested even in where did this come about. Best that I can determine, it's only 200 years old. Began with Schleiermacher, who began to talk about other religions as faith groups. Before that, I can't find it. It was faith referred to Christian. And I might one mention more. The word pistis in Greek had no religious connotation among the pagan Romans. It was Paul and Jesus that gave it that interpretation. It was not believing in something like Mark Twain once defined faith. Faith is believing something that you know didn't happen. That's the media's understanding of faith today, and Christianity get put into the same tent. And that's why it's important for us to make that a distinction. But you're going to go, like everybody else, something that we hear over and over before long, we imitate, reflect the same verbiage, and we don't really know. That, to me, is another example of the power of culture. I often used to tell my students that if a fish could think, the last thing a fish would discover is water. I'm convinced of it. With the human beings who, in the water of culture, swims about it every day, influences it, also is unaware of it. And when we echo terms like the Muslim faith, the Buddhist faith, we are betraying that the culture has overwhelmed the basic knowledge we have, namely that, as Paul said, I have kept the faith. Many have come to the faith. What is he talking about? Christianity and Christianity only.
There is a school of scholarship that argues that what is actually going on between Theodosius and Ambrose is not a struggle of church and state and not about the 7,000, but the fact that there had been anti-Jewish actions within the empire, and Theodosius had passed an edict saying that Christians should restore the property that they had destroyed of the Jews, and Ambrose had, in effect, stepped in and said no, that the Christians should be allowed to get away with it. What do you think of that school of scholarship?
One of those inconsistencies that happens, I guess, and what more can I say?
Thank you, Dr. Schmidt. In your opinion, was there a theological cost that Christians paid in order to get all of these wonderful advancements of making the culture Christian? Take, for example, the third commandment. I think there's some evidence that Constantine...
A little louder. I'm an old man. I don't hear that well.
Is this better?
Yes.
For example, I think there's evidence that Constantine also worshipped the Sol Invictus. And that's why he changed the day of worship from Saturday to Sunday. So is it worth it giving up a little bit on the third commandment in order to get these benefits in culture?
Is it what? The last part again?
Is there a cost that we gave up in giving up or compromising a little on the third commandment in order to get these benefits?
Well, I don't know. You know what Luther says about the third commandment. And you know, we even mistranslate the catechism to this day. We say, thou shalt keep the Sabbath day. That's not what Luther said. Luther said, thou shalt keep the Feiertag heilig, which is very different. In other words, first of all, as we know, Sunday is not the biblical Sabbath. It's a day other than that. And secondly, we as Lutherans have never been, I don't think, well, there have been exceptions. The old Iowa Synod, the old Ohio Synod had a lot of blue law mentalities. I remember growing up in Western Canada, a part of the old Ohio Synod at that time called the American Lutheran Church. The pastor would preach 45 minutes long for anybody who worked on Sunday in the late fall when the crops were almost beginning to rot. It was a sin to go out there and do it on Sunday. But it was not wrong to milk the cows, and I could never quite figure that one out. That was an example of, for example, of how we in some ways misunderstood Sunday, I think, even in Lutheranism. And it, you know, that doesn't follow what Luther mentioned, I think, in terms of the third commandment. We should, you know, not become blue law oriented. We were, however. And much of American Christendom was of that vintage.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you.